Hello and welcome to another RhinoCast. We are here today in the studio with Jeff Tate, lead singer of Queensryche. They have a new album coming out, Spring 2006, Operation Mindcrime 2. Of course, the sequel to 1988's Operation Mindcrime. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, John?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, let's talk about this new record. Mindcrime 2. It's been quite a few years since the original. Is this something you guys have been planning to do for a long time?
Well, not a long time, but I guess a couple of years now. It's been in the works. Well, actually, it took about 18 months to make the record. All the songs were written in about a four-month period, and then the rest of the time was spent making the record, actually recording performances and in between touring. So we kind of made this record piece by piece over a long period of time, different studios. Some of it was recorded in my house. Some of it was recorded in a studio in San Francisco, a studio in Seattle, and also in the back of several venues across North America and on a tour bus.
Excellent. For those who might not be familiar, can you kind of recap the storyline? We're dealing with a very conceptual two albums now at this point. Can you kind of recap the story of Mindcrime 1 and tell us where the second album picks up?
Yeah, Mindcrime 1 centrally is about a story of a young man named Nicky, who is a young kid who becomes part of an experiment by a very smart, crafty doctor who specializes in pharmaceuticals. And he develops this type of pharmaceutical that is a brainwashing agent. And he finds he's able to control the Nicky character and make him do horrible things like assassinate people. And so the young Nicky unwittingly becomes a terrorist. And during the story, Nicky falls in love with a woman by the name of Mary, who is now a nun, who was an ex-prostitute and junkie. And they find a very strong attraction to each other, become a couple, and both become manipulated by the doctor in the story, Dr. X. Mary has a untimely demise, and Nicky is finally caught by the authorities and convicted of murder and put away in jail. In the second album, it's a 20-year time difference between the two records. Because of state budget cuts, Nicky's allowed to go free after spending 20 years incarcerated. And he gets back into the real world, and the real world is, on a lot of levels, very similar to the world he left. There's a huge, very strong conservative religious fervor that's sort of, you know, gripping the country. The nation is at war once again, and the economy is truly in the dumper. A lot of people are losing jobs, losing pension plans, this kind of thing. Very similar to like life, what life was like in the late 80s. So in some ways it's very similar, and in other ways it's very different, of course, with digital technology and communications and that kind of thing. And but the burning motivator, I guess you could say, for Nicky over the last 20 years has been revenge. And so this record is really a study in revenge. It's about what revenge does to you as a person, how it eats at your soul, how it changes you. And kind of an interesting thing about this record is that at one point Nicky is captures Dr. X, and there's a confrontation. And what happens during that confrontation is sort of a bit of a mystery to the record that I think the fans will come up with many different scenarios as to what could have happened, what does happen, and will ultimately be ultimately be answered live when we perform the show.
Right. I take it this was inspired then by the current political climate that's obviously, you know, polarized this country to it.
Well, a lot of it was, yeah. I mean, I think I found it sort of ironic that the guy gets out of jail and, you know, Bush is in office, same as when he went into jail in the first place, you know. I thought that was kind of interesting. And I couldn't sort of resist bringing the story back now because of that one aspect.
Right. And I take it revenge does not triumph in this story. I don't know how much you want to give away. Is that the case?
I don't really want to comment on that too much. I'd like people to sort of make up their own mind about it, you know.
Gotcha.
It's a difficult situation. For one, you know, Nikki was convicted of murdering people, and usually that kind of conviction comes with, you know, somebody consciously killing somebody. Well, he didn't really consciously kill anybody. You know, he was made to do it by this drug that he was taking. So you have sort of a debate on what justice is from that point of view. You know, he didn't actually really do it himself. You know, it wasn't a free will act. So I think that's sort of an interesting debate myself, you know. And then so he, in his mind, you know, he spent 20 years paying for somebody else's crimes, and that someone else's Dr. X. So you can see where it would have a tendency to drive one mad, you know, or push them to extremes.
Right. You guys tend to be cited as one of the more contemporary bands that's able to make an extended narrative work. Make an extended narrative work in the context of a rock album. What do you think are kind of the your own personal, anyways, do's and don'ts of, you know, making such conceptual pieces of music?
Well, I think you have to have really good songs, for one. You have to have interesting musical parts and pieces. And then I think you have to leave some things to people's imaginations and let them come up with their own outcomes of things. Don't paint it out too specifically for them, or they don't really have a reason to return to the story again. I think people like to be challenged with a puzzle, you know? And so what we try to do with our records is make them accessible in terms of, we try to have really good, solid, strong songs that are going to attract people, for one. But then we like to put them in a context that's rather twisted and puzzling, so that people have to think a little bit about it.
Right.
And, I think that works for us.
Did you guys, maybe not so much now, but back in the earlier days, did you kind of study the classic rock operas, or take inspiration from, you know, Tommy and the Wall and stuff like that?
Well, you know, that was our music at the time. You know, we grew up as young kids listening to that. That was pop music, you know. So, yeah, you know, we knew the inside and out of every Who song, you know, and later Pink Floyd and Alice Cooper, you know, all the great rock stuff from that era, you know, late 60s, 70s stuff. Very, very influential.
Okay. What kinds of pressure come with releasing a long-awaited sequel like Mind Crime 2?
Well, I think the biggest pressure point is people's expectations. You know, and I mean that on so many different levels. For one thing, you know, fans of Mind Crime have been listening to the album for 18, 20 years. You know, they know it inside out. They know every song. They've come up with their own versions of the story. They've probably seen us live perform it. You know, they're very, very familiar with it. And the new record, they're going to hear it once and they're not going to get it. But they can't remember that the first time they heard Mind Crime 1, they didn't get that either. It took them a few times to listen to it. So, you know, as a musician and as a writer, you hope people come into what you do with an open mind and give it a few listens, you know, before they decide do they like it or do they not like it. I think with this record, people are definitely going to like it. Fans of the band will enjoy the music. They're going to like the story. They're going to love the live show because it's going to be very, very interesting, very entertaining.
Do you think you mentioned that, you know, they're not going to get it, but it seems to me they'll probably get it sort of in time in the same way they came to understand the first one. Do you think this one's inherently more difficult, or it'll be the same kind of process of understanding for the listener?
I think it's just going to be the same kind of process, but I think people don't remember the process they went through. I think it's something that we forget over time, that we've been listening to this thing for all this time. We've lived and breathed it. It's been the backdrop of our lives, you know, at various times. And so with any new record, you kind of have to go through that same process. You know, you have to give it a chance and live with it for a while.
Right. And you mentioned, I guess you guys toured recently. You toured the Mind Crime 1 in its entirety, right?
That's great.
You did that, and you had actors on stage. And so you'll obviously do that again with this record, you think?
Right.
Okay.
That's the plan.
Kind of in a similar vein, or will you have some surprises up your sleeves?
Well, it's what we're our goal is to create a very entertaining stage show, meaning that it's not just a band up on stage standing under bright lights performing their music, playing it, but there's actually a stage show going on around it. There's actors, there's film backdrops that put you into the scene of the story. Like, for instance, one scene of the story takes place in this very ornate Catholic church. And so the film screens, which surround the stage, all of a sudden become that room that you're in. And it's like you're in the pews of the auditorium, and you're seeing this, you know, all this ornate Catholic imagery, and there's an altar, and the whole scene takes place in front of you, and the actors come in and they're doing their part, you know. And it's like an opera or a musical, you know, rather than just a normal rock performance.
1 second. John, have you got some water?
Oh, yeah, right out. There's a box right out. So do you need
a
bottle of water?
Yeah.
Could you make that 3, John?
I'm nursing a cold.
Oh, yeah, I'm just getting over one. Thanks. I don't think he heard you.
Could you grab me one of those, John?
Sure.
Oh, thanks a lot. Okay. So you mentioned some of the kind of production values of your stage show. Are there certain pieces of technology available now that allow you to do things you wanted to do in the earlier years and maybe weren't able to?
Oh, yeah. Well, technology is, you know, a wonderful thing when it comes to live shows. When we first started bringing film aspects into our music, we were using big 35-millimeter cameras, or not cameras, but projectors that you'd see at a movie house, you know, and they weighed 600 pounds each, and they came in these giant steel crates, and they took all the special preparation and crew people to make them work and then set up, and then we're using real 35 millimeter film that would melt occasionally, you know. And then it's just gotten more compact and better quality now, and the cameras we use now are tiny little things that have so much more picture quality. It's unbelievable. And everything's now on DVD, you know, all our content and everything, and it's all we use Final Cut Pro, and it's all easily adaptable. If we want to change something night to night, You know, it's just a matter of a few little edits and we're done, and we can cut stuff in, cut stuff out. And we're constantly upgrading the show and changing it around and customizing it for certain markets, certain cities. We put, you know, imagery from New York City in the background when we're playing in New York and Los Angeles, same thing. You know, we use things like that that it's so on the fly, you know, where it used to be you couldn't do that. We were locked into one presentation, you know.
Right. What kinds of venues are your favorite as far as what you guys are doing visually and musically? Do you like? Do you prefer the theaters, the arenas?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Theaters are the ultimate place to perform music and to watch it, in my opinion. They're set up for listening to music, you know. They're not meant for a sports event. You know, it's about listening to music and seeing a visual presentation as well. And they have all the things you need, like, you know, the backdrop ropes and all the different platforms and just everything you need to put on a show. It's right there. It comes provided in the theater. You know, it's fantastic.
Right. I agree. For the benefit of the gearheads, and I'm certainly one of them, we talked about kind of technology in the visual sense. Do you guys have any new, you know, gear, gizmos, sounds that you've been working with recently that you're really interested in, kind of in the studio?
Oh, yeah. See, I'm not much of a gearhead, so I really wouldn't know too much about commenting on that. We use Pro Tools like you wouldn't believe. You know, we all have Pro Tools rigs. I've got one in my briefcase on my laptop. A lot of this record was recorded that way, you know.
Oh, sorry.
Hi, honey. Doing an interview.
Oh, sorry.
Do you want to come in?
No.
You can hang out if you like.
Probably 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
Okay. Sorry.
We'll meet
no
you
problem.
At Kenny's. Well, that's one of the beautiful things about audio technology, though, is, again, it's gotten, like video, it's gotten very small and compact and user-friendly. So now you can be in an airport and have a musical idea, and you can throw up GarageBand and put together a real quick simile of your idea and save it. And then when you get home or to a, you know, a studio, you can... break that song out and then replace all the instruments with, you know, great sounding instruments and something more customized to your type of music, what you're doing or whatever. And boom, you already have the template there, you know, of the song. So all you got to do is replace the sounds and you're off and running. You know, it's a great, easy tool to use to get your idea down, which is always the musician or the artist's or bane, is to have something at hand that's easy to use that you can get your idea out with without fussing and hours of setup, you know? Because
right.
If you lose the idea, it's gone, you know?
Now, when it comes to actually making the record, you guys still like to use the big old studios with the big drum rooms and outboard gear?
Somewhat, you know. We try to... it depends on what record you're making, you know? There used to be sort of a process that you'd go into a studio and you'd cut all the drum tracks... and that would be your sound of your drums, and you'd build the album around the drum sound, you know. But nowadays, you have so much flexibility in that respect where you can use a number of different drum rooms that all come within sound effect files and sample files, and you can build up these completely different spaces, you know. So each song can kind of take on its own sound characteristics, which is, I think, much more interesting, you know. And... you know, also, you know, you can, sometimes a big studio is fun to go to if you want to get that big drum sound, you know. A lot of studios that we worked at recently have been our own studios that we've designed over time, and some of them have real unique sounds, you know, that only show up on our records, but that's kind of cool too, you know.
No doubt. Okay, I want to kind of jump around a little bit. We've talked about kind of the new record and where you're at. Let me ask you, how did you come to sign with Rhino, you know, primarily a reissue label? mm-hmm. for your new album?
They asked us. Yeah. Well, Kenny Nemus is an old friend from EMI. And he and my wife, Susan, who is my manager, worked very closely with on the EMI projects together. And they have a really solid business relationship. And they're a good team, people working together, they feel. And Susan called Kenny one day and said, oh, you know, we're looking for a new label. And Kenny made an offer, you know, immediately. And we feel really comfortable working with him. And everyone we've met at the label so far has just been very excited about the project. And I tell you, you know, we've been on quite a few labels over the years, and it's really good to feel like the whole team of people is excited about the project, and everybody's kind of getting it and getting on the same page, because then it becomes so much more of a satisfying thing, you know, because, you know, you can't just sell a record on your own, you know. It takes a team of people, and it takes a dedicated focus, and everybody to be kind of on the same page and of the same mind, so to speak, you know. And it's a wonderful thing when that starts happening, and you can really feel the momentum grow and the excitement. And I love being part of that kind of thing.
Excellent. We're glad to have you. Mm. How has the online world kind of changed the way you reach fans and potential fans?
Wow, that's... The internet is an amazing invention. You have to kind of hold your cards close nowadays with what it is you do content-wise, and because everything moves so fast. It didn't be like that, of course. It would take months and months and months for people to find information out, and it would move a lot slower. And nowadays, you just have to kind of keep everything under wraps as much as you possibly can. And it's so difficult because everybody talks to everybody, and information is just flowing at such a rapid pace. I'm surprised our record isn't out on the internet already, you know.
Right.
It's only been like a few days since it's been mixed, so.
Okay. Again, kind of talking purely business, how do you think, you know, the marketplace has changed since you guys really hit big in 1990 with Silent Lucidity?
Oh, it's drastically changed. Yeah. That's, you know, kind of going back to your question earlier about, you know, challenges of releasing a record like Operation Mindcrime. Is one of the expectations that people have is they really look at records from a kind of a sports mentality of numbers and stats and how many units sold, how many awards you make, you know, these kind of things. And I've never looked at records that way. I've always looked at making a record as an artistic experience. It's an expression, you know. It's an idea that you share with people. I've never come at it from the sports mentality of you know, it, you know, that kind of rah, 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 raise your hand and fight, we're number one, you know, that kind of thing. I've never looked at it that way. But a lot of people do, and they say, oh, you know, well, Queensrÿche, they're just doing Mindcrime 2 because of, I don't know, financial reasons or whatever. There's nothing you can really do to fight that kind of idea, you know, because people make up their own minds what they believe and what they don't believe. I forgot what the question was, though, you asked me. It was something more direct than that.
Oh, how do you think the marketplace has changed?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think for the type of band we are, the kind of music we make, rock and metal and this type of genre has definitely gone underground in the last 10 years, where at one point, well, it came from the underground. You know, it was an underground type of music. And then it sort of got shoved into the limelight and, you know, in the early 90s and became pop music. And was all over the pop culture channels and the radio and all that. And then it's been replaced by a new type of pop music, you know. So our music is back really underground again. And I'm happy with that, you know. I like that. It's a there's no heavy media pressure, you know. You can kind of live life without having to move every 6 months because people are camping on your doorstep, you know. I like that very much. But it's definitely a different world, you know, out there. You know, rap music has sort of become the rock music of the millennium now, you know. It's having its day in the sun. And pretty soon, if all goes like everything else is gone, because everything goes in cycles, rap music will at some point be ridiculed to a point where it becomes embarrassing to own rap records. And then something else will take its place, you know, as the new flavor in American culture.
Okay, who are some of the contemporary bands that maybe you feel a kinship with creatively?
None.
Really?
Yeah. I don't really listen to other people's music.
Yeah.
I don't mean that to sound aloof or elitist. I don't have time, you know. I'm really busy listening to the music that's in my head all the time and just trying to get it out.
Right. I would have thought maybe the Mars Volta.
I haven't heard them.
They're very progressive, actually, and they do kind of conceptual, very cool stuff. But anyways.
That's a great name.
Yeah. Which leads me to another question. Related question. It seems like, I don't know how much of a gauge you have based on your last response, but seems like musicianship is once again respected after different times when maybe it wasn't so respected. You know, punk and grunge come to mind. Is that encouraging to you?
Respected by whom?
Kind of, I guess, the, well, the, you know, quote-unquote masses, you know, as far as, you know, I guess what you would call fashion trends in music. You know, there have been times when it seems like, oh, you know, three chords are better than, you know.
Well, John, I don't know. You know, that's a real, that's a big question. it's hard to answer that because I think there tends to be a lot of reliance on music press, you know, for people's opinions, because most people, honestly, don't know what's good or bad. You know, they really don't. And which is every day exhibited by people shopping at Walmart, you know, and these kind of places where quality is not important, but quantity is. So, you know, whether people now appreciate three chords or they appreciate some other, you know, musical mode that's more challenging, I don't know. I don't know what's popular, what's important to everybody else, because I can barely keep up with me.
Right. Now, you guys, you know, you haven't really followed the ebbs and flows of musical trends. You know, you've kind of
You mean chased them?
Yeah.
No.
You know, you've always kind of done your own thing. Mm-hmm. Have there been times when maybe you've been tempted to, or have you done things that maybe later you felt were a result of kind of keeping a finger on the pulse of what was going on?
Well, I think we're all guilty of that to some varying degree. I know with our guitar players in the band, they felt like they needed to experiment with drop tunings, which was a nightmare for me. I hate that, you know. And we did a couple records where, you know, the guitars were tuned way down to make them sound heavy, and which is one thing on this record. I put my foot down and said, look, let's go to A440. Let's go to the real tuning, you know, where everybody's ear is tuned to, you know, and where you can really hear pitch. And let's do that. And let's go back to that. You know, it works for us. We sound good that way. And, you know, enough trying to, you know, I don't know. I think music should be pitched at A440. It's my opinion. Sorry. But, no. Yeah, I guess to answer your question, you know, within a band, you know, it's difficult sometimes to, because you have these different personalities and they're all, it's all important for the personalities to be there. That's what makes a band cool, is the rubbing, you know, together of all these different personalities, the friction that it erupts. To keep a band going as long as we have with Queensryche, which is, you know, 25 years, you have to sort of learn to, you know, give people a little room to move and try out ideas. Even if you don't agree with them, you know, you got to kind of try to get on board to keep the team spirit alive, you know. So we've done that. We've all compromised little bits and pieces here to make the machine work, you know, over time. And it's weird because you kind of go through these different movements where, you know, all right, well, let's try drop tuning. You guys really want to do that? Let's see what we can do with it, you know. And you try that and it doesn't work for you, but you do it anyway. And, you know, then you kind of bring them back into your way of thinking. And it's the pulling, you know, pushing and pulling. And then pretty soon they'll come up with some other idea that brings you out there, brings you into their world, and I don't know, it's crazy. And then yeah, after time goes by, you look at it and you think, and you talk about it, and you go, hey, remember the drop tuning period?
Right. You know, we seem to be a kind
of
a
question?
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. We tend to like, you know, one or two word descriptors when it comes to music. I suppose they're convenient in some ways, but and you guys, you know, you're often described as prog metal. I'm wondering, I'm curious, is that a flattering term to you, or do you think there's a better way to capture the kind of music you guys make?
I think that, you know, people can describe us in any way that suits their vocabulary. I don't really have a preference, you know?
Right. So you're okay with both prog and metal, I take it.
I'm fine with whatever, as long as it's not stupid.
Right. Well, I asked you who are some of the contemporary bands you kind of you like. How about some of the older bands? Well, maybe something that would surprise people that you guys are into.
We honestly don't listen to music much, you know. The only music I listen to consistently is classical music.
Oh yeah,
I'm very interested in opera, and I want to do that someday. So I'm always listening to it. You know, all that's played in our house is classical music on every radio station in every room. It's all that way, you know.
Okay. What other kinds of art and, you know, maybe literature inspire you guys, kind of feed your creative process?
Well, it's different at different periods of time over the years. I think there was a time around 94, which is an album called The Promised Land that we did. I got really into this one writer, who his name is Fritjof Capra, and he is a scientist, really, and a writer at the same time, but he's interested in physics and sort of Eastern spirituality and the commonality between the two, and wrote an incredibly inspiring book called The Turning Point, which I used as a reference point for the album The Promised Land. I found a lot of interesting material in that applied to my life and what I was going through at the time, being of the age where you sort of start questioning your path in life and asking yourself, you know, well, what really makes me happy, you know? And also getting to a point where you attain certain goals that you've been working at for years. And what do you do when you get to that point where you've done that, you know? You've attained that goal. What do you do next? It's kind of a weird jumping off point that a lot of people find very uncomfortable. And I know I did, and so I wrote a record based around that idea. But lately I've been into, I'm a wooden boat aficionado. I have a classic yacht that I sail and have restored. And so I've been learning a lot about woodworking and carpentry and finding that there's a lot of zen in working with your hands and building stuff, you know. And so I've been reading books about that. I've been planning a long-distance sailing trip with my wife and kids. So I've been reading a lot of circumnavigational books and navigating, celestial navigation books, kind of how-to stuff. And also some really inspirational stuff. There's a guy named Josh Slocum who sailed alone around the world in 1899, first guy to ever do it and record it. And he wrote an incredibly beautiful book about his experience. And found that very inspirational.
Just him alone, solo, on the seas?
Just him alone, solo, on the seas, yeah, in a boat that he built with his own hands.
Sounds pretty terrifying to me.
Yeah, moments in the book, it is very terrifying. The accounts that he gives are terrifying and also very beautiful.
Right. Without asking you to get personal, how have your personal lives affected the way you guys record and tour? You know, marriage, kids, that type of thing.
Oh, yeah, that's always a challenge, boy. Well, you know, a band is a strange little delicate mechanism. And, you know, you've got your four or five personalities that somehow manage to click together. And you try to keep that working as best you can. And then everybody gets married. And now you have five new people coming into the organization that you have to sort of assimilate into the team, you know. Everybody's got to kind of get on the same page and understand what the schedule is like and the priorities here and there and the sacrifices. Then you start having children on top of that, and that brings a whole new set of challenges into the organization. So, yeah, it's a lot to juggle, you know. We used to tour, gosh, you know, 300 days a year, you know, and in the early days. But now we all have families and marriages, and so we try to balance our life between work and the rest of what life is. And so we try to cut back on the touring. We try to keep it at a reasonable amount of time away so that we can still reach the places we need to reach in the world and play shows and also be with our kids and not miss our life there, you know, because it's a terrible thing to, you know, miss your child's childhood, you know, growing up, that person that you made and that you influence. And how can you influence them when you're gone all the time, you know?
Right.
It's awful. So we've all taken that all very seriously and, you know, talked a lot about, you know, cutting the schedule back and keeping it within reach for everyone, you know.
Right. Now, do you guys live in different cities at this point?
Well, we all live relatively close to each other, within 20 miles.
Okay, that's very close. Mm-hmm. Very close by L.A. standards anyways. All right, well, let's wrap up here in a minute, but it just occurred to me, you guys kind of have had a kind of an ecological thread through some of your stuff. And I'm wondering, how do you feel about, you know, there's a lot of talk about global warming, alternative energy sources, you know, drilling in the Arctic, that type of thing. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm glad there's talk about it. And I'm glad people are broaching the subject. And I'm glad that the average person is now aware, you know, that global warming is happening. You know, quite a few scientists from all over the world have, you know, finally laid it on the table and said that this is finally happening. You know, really look at this. And I'm glad we're all talking about it because it needs to change. You know, as anybody that lives in LA knows, if you're on the freeway in the mornings or commute hours, it's ridiculous the amount of vehicles out there, you know, all with single occupancy drivers. And, you know, it's a tough thing, especially when You know, we're a media-based society, you know, a consumer society here in the United States. And, you know, we really exist. Our culture exists to buy and sell. That's what we're all based around. And the car companies have made billions of dollars selling us the concept of freedom wrapped up in one of these machines. And I think most of us can really look at that sort of tongue-in-cheek now and really relish our freedom as we're standing still on the freeway every day. You know, that's freedom, I'll tell you that, standing there waiting in line. Americans wait in line more than anybody else in the world. We have no problem with it. I guess we're all cows, huh?
As long as you're surrounded by a nice, smooth, shiny, comfortable thing with four wheels.
Well, you know, there's so many people. There's billions and billions of people, and we've invested so much in, you know, this one type of fuel. And not only is that investment in fuel hurting our environment, but it's also hurting our social environment, you know, how we deal with other countries and our relationship to the Middle East. You know, touchy ground we're on now. And a lot of people in intellectual circles are saying, well, look, we're smart enough, we're big enough, we're technology advanced here. Let's develop different fuel sources so we don't have to depend on the Middle East for our oil and our fuel. And we'll kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. You know, be less dependent on a foreign country or a group of foreign countries, and we'll clean up our environment so that future generations can live, for God's sakes. You know, how smart is that? Finally.
Well, I think that's probably a good note to end on then. Again, we're here with Jeff Tate, lead singer of Queensryche. New record is out spring 2006. Operation Mindcrime Part 2, and it's on Rhino. So thanks so much for being with us, Jeff.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.